close?
No, that's fine. This is the UBINC Military Oral History Program interview with Stephen Clues, recorded on March 24th, 2012, in New Westminster, Vancouver. He's being interviewed by Stephen Conquist. Master Corporal Clues, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Indeed.
Right on. I'm here as part of the University of Victoria's Veterans Oral History Project. I'm gathering interviews in order to help preserve the memory of Canada's mission in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Where are you from?
Well, I was raised in Surrey, and I currently live in the Lower Mainland area in Burnaby.
When and why did you join the Canadian Forces Army Reserves?
I joined as it was something that I wanted to do my entire life. I actually don't know why or when I came up with the idea. It's just something, as far as I can remember, it's been my focus and goal to do.
And what military train did you choose when you enlisted?
I originally chose armored reconnaissance. Through a series of mistakes, I ended up in armored reconnaissance, truth be told. I ended up at the regiment and was applying in as an assault pioneer, and they phased that that classification of job out just as I joined.
Could you describe that military trait of armored recce to me?
Armored recce is the ability to go forth and gather information on the enemy and ground in all phases of war and pass that quickly to a higher chain of command. Basically, it means that we're at the extreme pointy end. We go out and gather as much information as we can, sometimes with or without enemy contact, for the purposes of assessing or testing forces and trying to relay that information back so that way someone can use that in a greater role.
Spot on. Having eyes is always important. How long were you with your unit before you went overseas for the first time?
Before I actually left or before I went on workup training?
Before you went on workup training.
I left in October of 2006, and I joined the unit in September of 2003, so 1 year and or 3 years and 1 month with my unit before I left.
What kind of training did you typically do with your reserve unit back then?
Back then, we'd go out, and I was typically a gunner, and in a couple instances, a crew commander on exercises, going out in a patrol format. So usually four vehicle patrols. I would go out for purposes of vehicle checkpoints or gathering information in observation posts or dismounted reconnaissance.
Prior to either of your tours, what kind of training did you do?
The course I immediately did before I went on workup training was actually an infantry reconnaissance course, in which by a clerical error I ended up on. I was notified, questioned as to why I volunteered for a course without informing my chain of command, and since my name was already there, they just let me go to it, and I ended up completing this course with two other members of my unit who they put on after at the Seaforth Highlanders of Canada.
Did you get to use any new equipment that you hadn't been exposed to in the reserve world?
In the reserve world, I've used quite a number of different equipment. And when I left on workup training, absolutely. When I left on workup training, I began training with Leopard 1 C2 tank, which is the main battle tank of Canada. And upon my workup training, the purchase, whatever you call it, went through for the Canadian forces, and they bought the Leopard 2s. So they ended up sending me and my whole crew, as well as part of my squadron, over as the very first serial in Germany to go get training from the German Armored School on the Leopard 2 A6M.
And what roto of Op Athena was this?
This was roto 4.
So you were one of the first crews in this new armored fighting vehicle.
First crew.
What did you think of that experience?
It was definitely interesting, especially for an armored reservist going into the tank squadron. I was the first reservist in the actual main battle tank. The other reservists always got put in maintenance. So when I went through, having the opportunity to drive even the older Leopard 1 and then switch over to the greatest tank in the world right now, Leopard 2 A6, was a very interesting experience.
On your second tour, did you assume any new responsibilities, or did you have a different job in general?
I had a completely different job. My second tour, I went over as an armored crew commander for a Lav 3 RWS. And it was interesting because that yet again on that tour, we brought in that new vehicle, the Operation to Afghanistan. So I was the first serial on that course, as well as brought that vehicle overseas, which had an upgraded hull and a weapon system in which you could operate fully from the safety of the hull.
For either of your rotos, who were you training with? What did you think of your section, platoon, or company during pre-deployment training?
For my first rotation, I was with the Lord Strathcona Horse, and it was definitely a rough go at the beginning of workup training, as there was quite a bit of enmity towards reservists, as there was very kind of a huge bridge that had to be crossed between the reserve world and the reg force world. That ended up abruptly once we actually landed in operations in Afghanistan, as when we are all fighting the same fight, everybody kind of meshed a lot better. And the second tour we were with, the rotation, we were with the National Support Element, which was hosted by One Service Battalion out of Edmonton, or CFB Edmonton. And there wasn't so much enmity there towards reservists, but there was definitely a bridge between our platoon being the only combat arms and the service mentality, which is a huge difference. As you may know, combat arms, their focus is kind of much different towards support.
Moving on to the actual deployment, do you remember any initial impressions when you first arrived in Kandahar? And how did they change when you got there for the second time?
Truth be told, the very first impression I had for my very first tour was, dear God, it's hot. As it felt like I got hit in the face by a wall of heat. Because we went from leaving in negative 20 or negative 30 in Edmonton, Alberta, and then arriving in 60-degree heat in Afghanistan. So that was my initial experience with it. And then after that, it was a very go-go-go sort of mentality, as the other squadron needed an immediate pullout. So once we came, we did our initial... We spent a day in CAF, and then they immediately flew the entire squadron out in one shot, dropped us off, the other squadron got back on, and I think they left two or three people behind just to do a quick handover, and then we were on our own.
Were you pushed out to any FOBs immediately?
Immediately. From CAF, as I said, after the first day, we were pushed out to FOB Massengard, and that's where I spent the remainder of my tour as our main base. We did quite a number of operations where we did not come back to the base for quite a while.
Other than MSG, did you head out to any other strong points or areas?
Quite a bit. We consistently went to a patrol base. At the time, it was Patrol Base Wilson. And it later on my second tour, had actually been upgraded to FOB Wilson. And as well as Mushan, Talakan, and a number of bases that were actually quite west position, pushing towards the Helmand province.
And this is as your duties as an armored vehicle driver?
This is as my duties as an armored vehicle driver. As a crew commander on my second tour, we pushed out to FOBs consistently on resupply, so we hit pretty much the entire gamut of Canadian Forces positions.
The tank's operational duties in Afghanistan, were they part of a specific operational unit? Did you do force protection, or did you do...
We did active combat operations, usually in support of the... Well, not so much in support of the infantry, but as part of combat teams. A lot of the times, as we were pushing out, there was a lot of convoy security, but it was essentially assault convoys, where we'd either go out in a convoy looking for a fight, almost... I kind of compare it to the old-school British column, we'd go out and a lot of times we'd be poking forces until we could get into a fight and then go from there, or we'd be going out and securing positions. There was actually one instance where the squadron had to go and support an infantry platoon house that was being overrun, and we ended up setting up shop there for quite a while in support of them while they got their defenses up.
So you were doing security, or you were trying to provoke a fight from the insurgency?
Both. Both. We learn through our intelligence networks that there would be either weapons positions, IED factories, or Taliban personnel positions, and we just go and occupy that area until we go into a fight. It was pretty much, it was always reactionary, in the sense that if we were going to look for a fight, we'd put our forces in an area until one found us, or it would be in support of clearing operations in which we'd go and clear through a number of different compounds with infantry forces, and the tanks would be set up as a fire base.
And by your second tour, I'm guessing this had calmed down considerably.
My second tour, yes. But the only reason it calmed down is due to the change in nature of my operation and job. Forest protection had been, for quite a long time, notoriously unhit. For some reason, I guess the enemy never clued in to attack our convoys that much. Interesting enough, immediately after my tour ended, 2 weeks after actually my tour ended, my my replacement, who had actually given a bunch of equipment to, was hit with an RPG and lost a good portion of his left hand and was riddled with shrapnel. And after that, the Force Protection Platoon was consistently engaged in combat operations.
So, during your first tour in the tanks, did you find their offensive capability was used quite frequently?
Oh, absolutely. Trying to remember the first fight we got in. I think the first fight we got in was a week and a bit after we were there, and that was a squadron level operation. And then September 16th, actually was when I had my IED incident, was one of the biggest firefights, if not the biggest firefight that any of the Canadian Forces tanks had been in our entire operation in Afghanistan. So in the 10 years, or actually at that time we'd been the 5 or 6 years that we'd been there, 7 years, something like that, that fight has still yet to be unmatched in an operation in which the tanks were involved.
How do you feel about your equipment's overall effectiveness in Kandahar?
I was happy with it. Obviously the old tank definitely had some problems. But nothing too bad. The main problem it had was armor issues, as we've been using the same tank for years and years and years, and they had to add and weld on extra armor just from the overall wear and tear that it had taken over the number of years.
And this is the Leopard 1?
This is the Leopard 1. The Leopard 2, the issues I had with it was kind of more along the lines of procurement issues, because when they were coming in to operations overseas, they decided it would be cheaper to send them by sea and did not prepare them for any sea travel. So when we got them, they were completely rusted out on the inside and a bunch of the equipment was degraded. And so we had to spend the first few weeks reestablishing the functionality of the equipment and then having to go and do full weapons tests and operations, which actually delayed us putting the tanks into operation because we had to set up so many ranges to confirm their functionality.
Wow. How about your personal equipment that you were issued?
I had no problem with that. The only problem, the only minor problem was the tactical vest that they were issuing out at the time is useless. It is not a combat operations vest. It is a, at best, a peacetime support vest. It doesn't carry the proper equipment allotment that you would need. Further, the rifles that we had, we were using the, we'll call it the Mark 1 of the C8. And although the C8 itself is not a bad weapon, it's an excellent weapon for being a carbine variant, it was very old. And because of it being very old, it was, it did have some accuracy problems. The weapons were in use for like 30 years, well not 30 years, but like 20 years, and so it definitely wore them down. Once they started coming out later on in the years with the C8 heavy barrel, it changed that, it fixed those issues.
On your second tour, you had a new position, you were also given new equipment in the lab RWS. Could you describe your experiences with that platform?
Frustrating at best. The lab RWS was a weapon system that was, which they've even confirmed, was pushed through production faster than it should have been. And we had a number of issues where we had weapons malfunction overseas, which led to several of our gunners being charged, which was frustrating because we knew that they had done nothing wrong. They followed their procedures and steps, and yet they were still charged. under Section 129, which is conduct unbecoming, which doesn't even follow the proper charge format. But once we actually took them out to the range, because enough of us brought up the fact that these weapons were malfunctioning, we fired them until we got a malfunction, and we found out what the major part of the malfunction was, and we had to fix it. So again, that was one of the major issues through procurement, because it directly affected the morale and effectiveness of our troops, because they were becoming afraid to utilize the equipment because of reprisal.
Yeah, that weapon system, I believe it was developed and manufactured by Rheinmetall, Quebec, but there were definitely some issues, as I recall personally. But moving on, did you do much traveling around the province of Kandahar on both tours?
And, yes, on both tours.
How did that experience go from one to the other? You know, heavy armor to the light wheeled force protection.
The shift was very interesting. My direct, we'll call it interaction with the local populace, went through the roof on how much it happened on my second tour. As on my first tour, I was a tank driver, therefore I saw the inside of a tank for most of the time, and everything was seen through a mechanical distance of my my periscopes. But I saw a lot of the countryside on my first tour, and I have to say it was beautiful. It was a hell of an experience. But on my second tour, although I did kind of travel the country quite a bit, it was all on rogue travel, and it was kind of set routes, but I did have an interaction with people a lot more, and it was frustrating. We usually had to travel through Kandahar to get anywhere we want. But what I found really interesting is on my first tour, we pushed out as far west as we could go into our operational or our area of operations. And then on my second tour, we pushed as far east as we could go into our area of operations, all the way down to Spin Buldak on the Pakistan border. So it's an interesting dynamic that on the one tour I was heading west, on the other tour I was heading east.
So you've seen a lot of the country at this point.
Yeah.
Are there any specific events or situations you'd like to share from either roto?
I do have a few. One is ties into seeing the country. I also got to see northern Afghanistan at Bagram Air Base when I had an incident involving my eyesight due to a minor laser incident. So I had to be shipped up there to see in some form of specialist eye doctor, ophthalmologist or optometrist, whatever he's called, so that way they confirm I could see properly and wasn't going to go blind. But on my first tour, I'll share is my initial IED experience. September 16th, the really big firefight we got in. Actually, no. No, sorry, that was September 24th. September 16th, we were doing a route clearance package on Ring Road South down to Route Langley, pushing down to one of the other FOBs, patrol bases, which escapes my name at the moment. We'd hit a number of IEDs, and then one of the vehicles along the route just turns about 100 meters south of Ring Road South on Route Langley. That vehicle just ran over an IED. It was an anti-tank mine, and blew off their track. We were the next available vehicle, so we pushed up. We had the engineers clear a route for us, and then we pushed up to them. And as we were just coming off Ring Road South, my tank came down, and we struck a very large IED, actually. One in which killed my tank. It hit center mast, leaving a very deep impression mark on the bottom of my hull. It was quite wide and long, and it ended up injuring my gunner and my loader, so they had to be pulled out. We were spilling fuel everywhere. I had issues until from my perspective, I was sitting there, and as we were driving down, we kind of went down into this little wadi trying to come out. We struck the IED, everything shut off, everything went blank. Everything in my hull or in front of me was covered in mud. There was white smoke everywhere. I wasn't really sure what was going on. My ears were ringing, and all my warning lights started coming on, so I tried to get control of my tank. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I started hearing my crew call down, gunner okay, loader okay, all that jazz, so I called up driver okay, and then my crew commander was yelling at me trying to shut off the tank. I couldn't figure it out, and I wasn't really thinking at that moment, so I had to take off all my armor to try and squeeze through my top tank hatch in between my turret and the hull, as there wasn't much space, so I had to push everything out and got that, and then had to jump in, pop circuits, pull linkage, finally got the vehicle stopped, and then I kind of, the big part which got me was when I got up and I saw my loader and my gunner lying on the back deck. They were completely out of it. They were both going into shock. They had damaged their legs, and I went and I started working on them. And my loader, which was my sergeant, was completely out of it. And as we started, as I started checking the leg, there was no major bleeds or anything, but there was like stuff sticking out of his leg. And so he got confused and freaked out, so we had to calm him down. And we got them both medevaced, and then after that, I just carried on with the rest of the operation. And then we left other people to recover my tank, and then I kind of noticed some back pain from there, and I've actually been dealing with those issues since then. But it was my tank was the first tank to be fully written off in theater because of the damage. And if I was very close to dying, if it was a foot further ahead, then it's unfortunate, but what happened to my friend of mine would have happened to me, and that would have been my escape hatch blowing up and hitting me in the back of the head and killing me. My friend Michael Hayakaze, at the very end of the tour, hit an IED in the same sort of instance, which blew his escape hatch up and hit him in the back of the head, and he ended up dying as well. So,
at this time, did you have TCCT or Tactical Combat Casualty Care training?
Yes, I did. I was the only driver in the squadron with TCCC, and those skills definitely benefited me through the remainder of the tour.
Could you briefly describe what TCCC is?
TCCC is a Tactical Combat Casualty Caregiver. It's essentially an advanced first aid course that they give to select troops for the purposes of being a reactionary or initial medic. So it would include doing things like dealing with quick clot, advanced amputation techniques, inserting airways, and dealing with things like needle decompression if tension pneumothorax were to happen, which is actually fairly common in blast type injuries. So it's just more medical training in advanced role, so that way you can be an initial guy on the ground working on it, so you're not doing like the classical thing in movies, which is lying there screaming medic. And medics hate that.
Well, thank you for sharing those experiences. Moving on a little bit further, when did you get to go for home leave travel assistance on your first and then second roto, and where did you decide to go?
Both tours, I was there for a month, and then I was on leave. I'd actually specifically requested that, as getting my leave over and done with right off the start allowed me to focus on my job.
I would have to say, in retrospect, I would agree with you now, because I did mine. I was one of the very last people in the second roto's platoon to go on HLTA, and it's a bit of a drag returning to the country with only a month left to go. Where did you end up going?
My first leave, I ended up going to Australia, where I went on a Kentucky tour. And I admit, on my first tour, the first month there was a very, we'll call it depressing month. A lot of things happened, especially as a very young gent going on a tour. I hadn't had much experience beforehand, and then I got swamped with a whole lot of experience in that first month, so I had a rough go. But luckily enough, when I went to Australia, I was taking a Kentucky tour, ended up meeting up with, just randomly, in my kind of communal room that I was in before my tour started, a very tall, red-headed gent walked in, and we started talking, kind of gave each other the awkward, like, seemed familiar look, and then we started talking. He turned out to be an infantry captain from my tour, who was on the same Kentucky tour, so we spent most of our time swapping stories and kind of supporting each other. And on my second tour, I ended up bringing my my girlfriend out with me to Thailand, and we ended up just touring around Thailand, where I also participated in a Muay Thai boxing gym, or kickboxing gym there. So during the day, I'd be doing kickboxing training, and then during the evening and on the weekends, I'd be going out with my girlfriend and touring the country.
Did you feel the HLTA helped with the rest of your tour?
I don't think the HLTA helped with my tour in any bit. I thought they were an added bonus on going on tour, but in no way for me did the benefit of going and drinking a lot help me in the long run of going on tour. Would I want them to take it away? Hell no. I had too much fun. But I don't view it as a benefit to my tour, but I definitely view it as a bonus of going on tour.
When did you start getting replacements for your operational units on your first or second tour? How did getting them ready for the job go in either case?
Well, my first tour was bracketed by bad events. So at the very last day on March 3rd, I believe, we ended up conducting a very large operation in which we got into several ambushes and several of our tanks were critically killed, or mobility killed, and one of our tanks was critically killed in which killed Trooper Hayakaze. This was an op that was pushed off last minute, so we were gearing up to leave, and actually the day that Hayakaze died was the day he was supposed to be flying home. And everything just got pushed to the right. So when we actually did finish that operation, we finally got back to FOB Massengar. We had a few hours to pack up our stuff, and then once that was done, they called in Chinooks for us, and the new squadron got off. We all got on. We just left them a bunch of notes saying what to do, and it was kind of a, like, you're on your own sort of deal, but we didn't have much of a choice because, to be honest, they wanted us all out of there.
And how does this contrast with your force protection tour when you were a crew commander?
My force protection tour, I showed up as the very last guy to enter theater, but I was also the very last guy to leave theater. So I have no idea what the handover was for when we showed up. I was told that other people were there, but by the time I got there, the entire last platoon was already gone. For me, I was the last handover guy, so I stayed for 2 weeks after everyone else was gone, and I stayed as one of their main advisors and actually as their VPS commander most of the time to do a handover, and I actually was able to give them a lot of experience. They showed up, a lot of their crew commanders showed up without any experience on the Lab RWS, which was going to be their main vehicle. So myself and one of the other Master Corporals, well, a couple of the other Master Corporals essentially ran a impromptu Lab RWS course there. And myself and one of the other Master Corporals took it upon ourselves to try and go as much in depth as we could. So we spent a good portion of the time on their off time taking them out and running them through gun drills and driving around the camp and getting everything geared up so that way they could have as much experience commanding and using the system, the vehicle, as well as some emergency driver experience. But as much experience on the vehicles as I could before they got into it. So our handover to them was actually fairly in-depth.
Presumably there were a lot of quirks you had to impart upon them with this relatively new piece of kit.
Oh, yeah. There was definitely a lot of angering points that we told them to avoid. But the biggest thing we could impart upon them is trust your gunner. And he knows his drills. He knows what he's doing. And this is one of the rare circumstances where... you're definitely going to be blaming the equipment, not the person, more than anything else, as there were so many issues. The drills were sound, the equipment was not.
Would you describe the vehicle itself as being fairly effective, as opposed to the weapon system?
The vehicle itself was fantastic. The lab, the platform, was amazing. The mobility, the maneuverability, and the overall capabilities of the LAV hull as in a driving platform is fantastic. The amount of personnel and equipment that it can carry in the back is amazing, and especially with the upgraded versions that we have, essentially the Lorit hull, it had increased blast protection. It had capabilities and abilities to prevent the crew from being injured on the inside, and it's just a great vehicle. I love bombing around in that thing. It was fast, and we could get it into some really tight spaces.
After leaving the area of operations, where did you get flown to, and what was decompression like?
Both times I flew to Cyprus, and both times I don't remember the first night I was there. But the decompression was all right. Some of the classes, it was mandatory classes, and they're useless, but there still needs to be a little more hammering out with how the decompression works, in my opinion. Just because some of the stuff they taught us was good, but nobody is paying attention. And a lot of the times what's needed for decompression is just guys to vent themselves out of the war zone. Like, I know, was it World War II, they, in World War I, they were spending weeks on cargo ships forced to each other. And that was essentially their decompression. They had a time to fight, get angry, cry, whatever they needed to do, and so it was a lot easier adaptability for them coming home.
On that note, now that we use aircraft to get to and from Canada, how did your trip back to Canada go? What kind of reception did you receive once you got there?
It was all right. Both times flying into Edmonton, both times had the police escort and everything and the highway blocked off for us coming back, which is always nice. And it's kind of cool, but... and both times, you know, the plane was escorted by the CF-18s, which is, it's kind of neat in a way. I like the whole honor guard mentality. It's pretty cool, but it was also pitch black, so it's not like you can see anything. No, it was good. The biggest point for me wasn't so much the random people, it was friends and family. When I came back for the first time, I wasn't expecting anybody there, and my cousin Dave ended up showing up, and that meant the world to me, because instead of spending the nights in the shacks by myself, I ended up going to his house and spending time with family before I went and cleared out of the base and went home. And the second time, it was the same sort of thing. I had my friends show up there, as well as my cousin Dave showed back up, and he gave me another extra large Tim Hortons coffee, and then I couldn't sleep all night, but I got to see family, so that's what meant most to me.
Well, that's great to hear. When you were back in Canada, how did you adjust to life home again? How did you feel about working with your reserve unit again?
The first time I came back, I didn't adjust. I had some problems when I came back, and I know that. Definitely on the anger side, I actually had to carry around my safety blanket with me, my safety blanket being a backpack that had some... stuff which was questionably legal, and medical equipment, and essentially it was a jump pack that I could just get up and leave for a few days without any preparation. And it took me months and months of carrying that around before I could let it go. And then I went back on my second tour for vengeance reasons. I lied my way onto getting onto tour to the social workers, to the padre, to everybody, saying that I just wanted more experience, things like that, when I was going back for blood. I was very unhappy with some of the, well, with the amount of friends that I lost and the amount of friends that were wounded on my first tour, so I was definitely going back for the wrong reasons. Once I got there, I smartened up because I saw my crew there, and it definitely... The biggest thing for me is... One of the days I went to orders when we were at FOB Massengar. We got updated orders saying that one of our vehicles was going to be specifically targeted by an 82 recoilless. And I came out of orders happier than could be thinking, and I was going to walk the entire time and try to bump a fight. And as I was coming back, I saw my crew sitting on the back deck and decided that their lives are more important than my want for blood. And that is I still believe that is the single deciding factor on when I became okay.
Well, that's a really powerful story. And as a junior military leader, I'm sure that played a really important role in how you conducted your duties as a crew commander. Well, so far, thank you for sharing your experiences for the program. Are there any closing comments you'd like to add to the interview?
I think the only closing comment I'd like to add is that the face of war is changing. Wars like World War I and World War II, I don't think are going to happen anymore, and it's going to become... It is a very skirmish kind of operated warfare, but that doesn't change the abilities or duties or even unfortunate downsides and experiences that you have to be faced with warfare. And it's just something that I really hope is kind of carried on throughout the years, where guys who aren't involved in giant world war scale wars are still viewed as soldiers.
Well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Stephen Clues on the 24th of March, 2012. Thank you for your time, Steve.
You're welcome.
And we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.